This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, staff, sponsors of the station you're listening to. They're my views. And this evening they're going to be the views of Sarah Susan McLaughlin. We're going to be talking about a local ballot initiative here in the Monterey Bay. But this principles that are behind this initiative certainly could be understood and would be applicable to things that are going on all across America today. Now, first of all, I should comment that we live in a community that is about as far to the left as you can possibly get. This area was originally set up and taken over under the auspices of Tom Hayden, who was one of the most radical people here in the state of California. And really for the last 25 years or more, why the radical left has controlled both the city council and the board of supervisors, and they've had a program here. They've sold to the people, oh, we want to maintain this is just a quaint little community, and that's why we're not developing any roads, because after all, if there are roads, why people will come here. So we're going to have things as crowded as they can be, so that people will not want to come to Santa Cruz and live here, because it's such a nice place, why we want to keep it all for ourselves and not anybody else come. Well, for 30 years now, they blocked efforts to widen our highway through the town itself. This is an area known as Highway 1. So recently, they've come up with a wonderful idea. It's called Measure J. They want a half-cent sales tax that will go on, I don't know, for 30 years or something. A raise about something like $500 million over this period of time. And about 60% of that money is going to be used to widen the highway. And then an awful lot of people who say, well, gee, we want to widen the highway. But unfortunately, there's another agenda behind what's going on. And that's why I've asked Susan to come and talk about it. Because this is all part of something called Agenda 21 that applies to wherever you're living. Now, there is a master plan for everything going on in America today. It's called Sustainable Development, and of course it's epitomized by the Earth Charter, but really, of course, it was all laid out initially in something called the Global Biodiversity Assessment that came out of the Second Earth Summit in Rio de Janeiro in 1992. Because of the degree of control over the media, the average individual has no idea what the plan is. We have summarized that in our Sustainable Development Syllabus. You can actually get the 1,152-page book published by Cambridge University Press. It's called Global Biodiversity Assessment. And then, of course, how do you apply this as Agenda 21? Well, we actually have an Agenda 21 plan here in Santa Cruz. And I'm going to let Susan tell you a little bit about what is in the Agenda 21 plan. Susan, why don't you explain to our listeners what sustainable development is, what Agenda 21 is, and how this project that they have here, so-called widening of the highway, would apply not only to what's happening here in Santa Cruz, to what's really happening all across America, indeed, all throughout the world today.
Well, sustainable development is a really warm, fuzzy kind of description for something that is very cold, anti-human and anti-freedom. Sustainable development, if you took the antithesis of it, isn't unsustainable development. It's actually loss of property rights and loss of freedom. Sustainable development means you have to give those two things up in order for sustainable development to exist. Now, it gets implemented in a lot of ways. It's starting out with the President's Council on Sustainable Development, And it has been brought down through the state. Through
hold that thought for just a minute there. All right, Susan is talking about what is sustainable development, and it's a program that's really a national, really an international program, but it starts, at least in this country, with the federal government, from the state government, down to the county and the local government. So pick up the story there. What is this whole program really about?
Well, once the President's Council on Sustainable Development was created, they brainstormed ideas about how to spread sustainable development through the states and into individual locales and communities. And the way that they planned to do it was through an international framework called Agenda 21. Now, Agenda 21, you may have heard of it or you might not have heard of it. In some countries, they're very open about Agenda 21. It's a program developed by the United Nations. In this country, where I think most citizens would be really doubtful or concerned that the United Nations would be telling us how to live our lives, they try to disguise Agenda 21, and they call it sustainable development. And they say that we're implementing a plan to preserve for the future generations all the things that we have today. In Santa Cruz County, a local Agenda 21 plan was implemented in the early 1990s, and one of the effects that it's had is a bad effect on our transportation system. In Agenda 21, freedom of mobility is not allowed. So in order to accomplish Agenda 21, you will allow the freeways to become congested, to not plan for growth, to make people so miserable about driving that they won't get in their cars anymore. And Measure J, although it claims to widen the highway here in Santa Cruz County, will actually make the congestion worse. And that goes right in line with the idea of sustainable development in Agenda 21. Make it worse for people. Make the congestion worse.
Well, of course, now, Susan, most people think that if we're going to widen the highway, that's going to make everything fine. After all, everybody wants to widen the highway. Everybody wants better roads. Everybody wants to be able to have the traffic flow more rapidly so we're not sitting there bumper to bumper in rush hours. So what's wrong with widening the highway?
Well, there's a problem with widening the highway, especially if you're paying for it with your tax dollars and you're not allowed to use the extra lane. It's like King Tantalus and the grapes. You'll be sitting in the congested lanes watching an empty lane next to your car with an occasional vehicle, maybe with a higher occupancy load or possibly the emergency vehicles going down it. But most of the time it will be empty or much less used than the other two lanes on the freeway. In fact, the high occupancy vehicle lanes generally only get 10% of the traffic. The other 90% still sits in the two lanes.
Hold there. Hold right there. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and of course the point that Susan is making is that nobody has read the initiative very carefully. All they've heard is the hype, what they've been told by the newspaper, what they've been told by the proponents of this program, all this is going to solve our problems. No, it is designed not to solve the problems, because and during the congested times when we would want those lanes to be open, you can't use them. Only people can use them are in carpools, emergency vehicles, and buses. And so those lanes are going to remain empty, and it's not going to accomplish anything at all. It was never intended to accomplish anything. It was intended to specifically frustrate the people, to manipulate the people, to increase congestion, and down the line to drive people out of their cars onto bicycles, into mass transit, into the new train system that they're going to put in. And they're simply deceiving the public intentionally. Would that be a fair statement, Susan?
I have to agree with that. And all of these terms and all of these ideas that they're pushing down on local communities are deceptions. The idea that you can sustain development by giving up your prosperity and your private property. The idea that by creating a high occupancy vehicle lane that no one's going to use is going to alleviate traffic congestion is a deception. The whole program of Agenda 21 is a deception because they won't even say its name when they're implementing it. And I say they as the county officials and the people who are on the councils that come into the communities and set up the local agenda action groups that bring Agenda 21 to your neighborhood.
And I think that's so important to realize that, first of all, this is going to raise about $500 million, supposedly, for the highway, except only about 60-some percent, 62, 63% of this are going to go to the highways. A lot of this is going to go for putting in bike lanes. A lot of it is going to go to the supervisors for some sort of any sort of a fund they want. Some of it's going to go to putting in this beginning this mass transit system, which is really what they want, a railway system. Now, we're a beautiful little seaside community, and the idea that we're going to put in a major railway system here that is going to hook up with Monterey and eventually is going to hook up with the rest of California, and we're going to get people out of their cars onto railroads, is absurd, and yet that is the plan of Agenda 21. Now, you can look at what Amtrak is doing. In fact, if you look at the finances of Amtrak, why, it would probably be lots cheaper simply to buy everybody who rides Amtrak a plane ticket so that they could go by plane and we would actually save money. We have to put so much money into subsidized Amtrak. But that doesn't matter. It doesn't matter that it's impractical. This is what the Agenda 21 calls for, and everything is about controlling the people and getting them out of the cars, getting them onto the bicycles, and of course, this is what they do in Santa Cruz. Now, they widen the roads, and then they put bicycle lanes on either side, and then we have two little narrow one-way streets with these wide bicycle lanes in them, and nobody's on the bicycles. But they believe they can force us onto the bicycles.
Yes.
They believe that they can force us to do whatever they want because they're so much smarter than the rest of us.
And not only that, they're using our money to do it. So if they raise the sales tax with Measure J, if this measure is approved, you are going to be paying extra money for all the goods you purchase, and the money that you pay is going to be used to socially engineer you into behaving like a good, sustainable citizen, and that would be a person who does not drive a car and possibly walks bikes or uses a train, if a train exists. And it's interesting that you brought up the cost of Amtrak, because a local plan for a train system that would take people from a station in Watsonville, the Pajaro station, into the Silicon Valley and up to San Francisco would cost the taxpayer, every time a rider set foot on the train, at least $30, no matter how far they went, whether they went to the next stop or they went all the way to San Francisco, and would also take 4 hours for that rider to get to San Francisco. So is that practical to go to work? I don't think so. If you have a sick child, are you going to take your child on the train to the doctors? What does that do to all the other people who are riding the train? The wisdom of the people who are pushing this agenda on us is very lacking.
I don't think the wisdom is lacking. I think they're just deceitful. One of the things that they have now, right now they're talking about putting in a 7-mile railway, supposedly a scenic railway so that people can ride 7 miles from an area we call Capitola to Aptos, 7 miles. And, of course, they're going to put $9 down to make this trip. But they're going to make extra money by carrying freight. And they spent a lot of money to get a group of experts coming in to say, well, now we can actually make this whole project pay for itself by carrying freight. Now, I wonder how many people, you know, in our community or anywhere in the country believe that people are going to pay large sums of money for freight to go 7 miles from one small city to another small city. You know, how much money are you going to be able to charge for that freight, and then how are you going to get it delivered to one station and picked up at the other station and delivered to where it's supposed to go? But it's all a lie, but if you tell a lie often enough, people will believe. It's sort of like with electricity. Do you remember how they sold us electricity deregulation?
Oh, yeah.
Electricity deregulation was going to lower the cost of electricity. And some people said, no, don't you understand? It's going to raise the price of electricity. Oh, no. Oh, no, you don't understand. We have this all worked out. We know exactly what's going to happen. We are going to lower the cost of electricity. And there were a few of us out there who were saying, no, this is designed to raise the cost of electricity. And we were labeled and demonized and yelled and screamed at and put down and humiliated. But, of course, the real purpose behind electricity deregulation was to raise the price of electricity. It goes right along with this whole Agenda 21 of getting electricity up prices higher so that we will lower our living standards and stop using air conditioning and turn the lights out and conservation. but it's all about lowering our living standards. But they can't tell the American people that any more than they can tell them the truth about Measure J here, which is not to solve the congestion problem, it's to increase the congestion problem.
It's interesting that you brought up the idea that sustainable development lowers your standard of living, because in all my years of working in the Silicon Valley, never until we had electricity deregulation did I have to sit in an office where all the lights were turned off, except the only light you got was from your computer monitor. And for days at a time, it would be that way because of the supply problems and the brownouts. And I can't tell you how bad that is for someone's eyesight to be sitting in the dark, and how dangerous it is to try to negotiate your way if you had a fire or an emergency in a four-story office building. You can't use the elevator. You have to use the stairs. The whole idea of pushing scarcity on people and making the American people believe that there isn't enough of anything is right behind the concept of Agenda 21.
And, of course, this is a program of a group of very wealthy people, an elite group. In fact, it really all came out of a meeting that was held on the good ship Britannia. The royal yacht of Prince Charles, and he'd called together people from all over the world, the financial and business leaders, and Al Gore was there in 1991 when they hammered out this whole program that then went over to the Second Earth Summit and was adopted by representatives of the entire world. It is the blueprint for a dictatorship, but that is exactly what these elitists really want. And they want to lower our living standards. Now, admittedly, not their living standards.
That's right.
But they want to lower our living standards. They want to get us out of our cars. They're not going to get out of their jet planes. They want us to live with less electricity mm-hmm. and less water and less natural gas. And they are intentionally driving up the price of all of these. They know exactly what they're doing. The last thing, though, is they want the American people to know. And as the price of oil goes up, oh, it's those terrible Arabs. It's in Iraq. It's the sabotage in Iraq. It was a hurricane. That was what it was. No, ladies and gentlemen, they are intentionally driving up the price of oil because they want to get you out of your car. They raise the price of natural gas artificially so they can get you to begin to turn down the use of, stop using natural gas so much. They know exactly what they're doing. There is a master plan, and you can read it in Agenda 21. You can read part of that in the Santa Cruz Agenda 21. It's all laid out. They wrote it out for us. It is the roadmap to what's going on. And I wonder how many people in Santa Cruz have read Agenda 21. Now, we carry that through Radio Liberty. It's available if you call our 800 number, 1-800-544-8927. Our sustainable development syllabus with a summary. The global biodiversity assessment is available. But right now, of course, the important thing is Measure J. They need two-thirds majority to get it through. I just hope that the good people of our community are smart enough to realize that this is a scam. If you really want to trust these people with all that money, how do we know that down the line they're not going to change their mind and decide that for one reason or another they're going to continue the program that they have for 30 years of blocking, of widening the highway? Now, what about the Zayanti Dam? You mentioned that when we talked earlier.
That's exactly right.
What is that all about?
Well, they collected money with the citizens of Santa Cruz, passed a bond. The money was collected for 30 years. And then the political powers at the time decided that it was not a politically feasible, not a technical feat or engineering feat, but politically feasible to build a reservoir. So they collected the money, but no one has any accountability as to where that money went. And we do not have that reservoir, and we have had water shortages.
And, of course, this was designed to stop water shortages. It was provided all the water that our county needs for the next 50 years or so. They did not want a solution to the problem. They wanted water shortages because then they can begin to manipulate the people. If they can control the water, they can control the people. They don't want solutions. They want problems. This is how they work. And until you begin to understand that these people on the other side know exactly what they're doing, everything is orchestrated. They dedicate their whole of their lives to controlling the rest of us. There aren't very many of them, but they're dedicated, and you got to give them credit. They believe in what they're doing. How many people really believe in freedom? We're going to be back here in just a moment with Susan McLaughlin, and we'll, of course, invite your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Here in the Central Coast of California, 464-8295. If you have any thoughts, what's going on in your area, what's going on here, give us a call. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this evening is Susan McLaughlin. We're talking about a Measure J on our local ballot here in the Monterey Bay area, actually in Santa Cruz County, to raise funds to widen Highway 1. But, of course, if they widen Highway 1, it's not going to do a bit of good, because in the peak times, in other words, peak traffic times, you're not going to be able to use those lanes. That's how it's designed. But I wonder how many people have already read the fine print on Measure J to realize that what the reason they want this passed is to create more chaos to force people out of their cars. So because the buses are going to be able to move very, very readily in that new lane. It's just the rest of us aren't. So pick up the story there, Susan.
Well, before the break, we were talking about the Zionte Reservoir and how money was collected for it, but it wasn't built because there has been a sea change in the way our politicians think about us and our future. In not so long past, a politician would work to provide for the future. They would make sure that the freeway was built so it could accommodate growth. They would make sure that there was abundant water, abundant power, because when all these things are abundant and readily available, then people can have economic prosperity, and that used to be important to our elected officials. But something has happened to them, and I think you can call it sustainable development or Agenda 21 or a global mindset that people need to be controlled and their use of the earth needs to be controlled. And so they have come up with this idea, Agenda 21, to control us and socially engineer us into using less electricity, using less water, not driving our car so much. How many times have we been told, you don't get enough exercise, you should really ride your bike, you know? Well, the people that are telling us this have no idea what our lives are like, and they don't know how hard it is sometimes to, say, get to your place of employment. If you live 30 or 40 miles away, you're not going to ride your bicycle to work. And if you have a sick child, are you going to take that child on a bus or a train to go visit a physician? I think the whole idea behind this Measure J and the chaos that it's intended to create in the county is to make driving so unbearable that people just give up on it, that they won't even try anymore.
Well, and that seems like a, sort of a very difficult thing for a lot of people to believe, but I've talked to people on the Planning Commission who have told me that they are intentionally have not put the major arterials across town to relieve congestion because they want the congestion. Because they want people bumper to bumper. They want to force people out of their cars. And, of course, I remember this one fellow I met at the car wash who was on the Planning Commission who told me that while we were there and he was getting his car washed, our Board of Supervisors, every one of them, has a county-supplied car. They don't want to get out of the cars themselves. They want to get the rest of us out of our cars. And, of course, it is this elite concept that there is one set of rules for the elite. There's another common set of rules for the common folks.
Well, if any of your listeners are have experience trying to get through the county during rush hour, especially after 3 o'clock in the afternoon, which is when rush hour starts around here, maybe they've experienced the stress of trying to go pick up a child from daycare knowing that for every minute you're late, it costs you $1 a minute. And it may be that some of the listeners in your audience might have been one of the people that have told me, I never go to Santa Cruz anymore. There's nowhere to park. I hate driving down there. You know, there's probably a very large percentage of the people in this county who've stopped visiting the city of Santa Cruz precisely for the reason you state.
Hold that thought for just a moment. We'll pick up our stations. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this evening is Susan McLaughlin. We're really talking about a local issue, which is Measure J. The idea that we're going, of course, to give $500 million to our local Board of Supervisors. Well, of course, they're only going to use 60-some percent of that to widen the highway, but do we really trust them to widen the highway when all these years they've blocked that? But imagine they do. If they widen the highway, they've stipulated that the common folks will not be allowed to use the new lanes they're going to put in either side. They're only for carpools. They're only for the emergency vehicles and for buses. And it's not going to do anything at all to relieve the congestion on the regular highways. And they know that. In fact, one of the people who's really pushing this at a recent meeting, after the meeting was over, got up and said, the real purpose of Measure J is to force people out of their cars. We're going to be able to get them out of their cars if we can get Measure J through. And of course, they're going to be taking a lot of the money they're getting and putting in bike lanes, and all you need to do is travel around Santa Cruz. Most of those bike lanes are absolutely empty, but that doesn't matter. This is an idea, and they are totally dedicated to an idea. Doesn't matter how ridiculous or foolish it is. This is their policy, and it's going to be enforced, and it's going to be forced upon the people of this community, because the good people are doing nothing, and the people from the radical left who are part of this Sustainable Development Agenda 21 movement, they know exactly what they're doing. They have a master plan. And
they
that's
do.
Why everybody needs to read Agenda 21, needs to read the Global Biodiversity Assessment or our summary of that, and pick up the story there, Susan.
Yes, the same politician you mentioned about getting people out of their cars also wrote an article about 2 years ago that was published in the county, in which it stated that in Santa Cruz County, there is a desire to create communities that are less reliant on automobiles and which grow by infill and intensification of residential development.
What she means is crowding.
She wants to crowd people in. Now, I know the reason I moved to Santa Cruz County, and I know the reason a lot of people moved to Santa Cruz County. We loved the small-town atmosphere that you got here. Even though there's three or four cities of some size, they still look like the hometowns that you can imagine from the old days. There's a little bit of a downtown. They're spread out a little bit. But this idea that you will get people out of their cars and on trains, and you'll have to build them houses next to the train tracks so that they can ride them, because if they don't have a car anymore, they won't be able to get to the station.
Well, I think one of the most significant things, Susan, is the fact that this has gotten absolutely no coverage, certainly in the local newspaper and not the left-wing newspapers, but they've authorized the building of 10,000 new high-density structures right here in Santa Cruz, and they'll be going up with 10,000 more families, probably, you know, each one with a car, vying for space on the freeway, and it's been totally suppressed by the controlled media locally, so the average individual doesn't know that these people have been talking about keeping the community small are actually authorized 10,000 new buildings. Would you like to tell our listeners a little bit about this incredible program that nobody knows about?
Well, it's the housing element for the general plan that you're talking about, and that plan is being developed currently in Santa Cruz County, and it's not clear exactly when they're planning to ratify it, but in the plan, they want to do, the county says and the planners say, we must do infill development, we must make underutilized areas more dense, and what we're going to see if Measure J passes, the 37% of the money that doesn't get spent on the high occupancy vehicle lanes will be spent on establishing funds and programs to implement the housing element and what they call the rail trail faction of the housing element. So when these apartments or high density housing projects are built, it's not that people are coming to the county finding jobs and applying for permits to build them. The county is forcing them to be built, and many homeowners are going to find if a disaster strikes and their home gets damaged in an earthquake or has a fire and must be rebuilt, they're going to find out that they won't be allowed to build a single-family home on their lot. They're going to be forced to build a residential unit for four or five families if they want to rebuild. And, you know, that's going to take home ownership away from a lot of people because not everyone has the money to build an apartment complex to replace their home.
And I think that people have to understand this is the fascist mentality of these left-wingers. They believe if you have the power of government, you should be able to do whatever you want to. They don't believe in the Constitution. They don't believe in individual freedom. They don't believe in individual choice. Everything is to be collective. And, of course, they will lead the collective.
So, and they are designing these communities so that you will think like a collectivist and not like an individualist.
That's right. And that's, in fact, the end of individualism, unless the American people are willing to take a stand. We'll be back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening is Susan McLaughlin. We're talking about this idea of changing transportation, and, of course, all across America today, they're trying to put in these light rails. This is the master plan. Of course, we're going to get people out of their cars that conserve energy. Of course, nobody ever talks about how they're going to run the trains. They're going to have energy for that and the buses. But we're going to get people out of their cars, and then we're going to force them to go on to mass transit of one sort or another, or to get a bicycle, because they love bicycles. After all, many of these people have even talked about how wonderful the society is in Beijing, where everybody has a bicycle. The only trouble is, over in Beijing, the people want to get off their bicycles and get automobiles. So they're going to automobiles, and we're going back to bicycles. And what's wrong with this picture? Well, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California, at 464-8295. Central planning doesn't work. But, of course, these people are intent upon doing it anyway. We saw what happened in Russia. It didn't work. It wasn't until they began to loosen up their central planning that China began to take off. And yet we are adopting these failed policies that will lead only to disaster, with a loss of freedom, because once you take away property rights, you take away the basic human right that we all have. Go ahead, Susan.
Well, you know, the idea that there is central planning going on is pretty evident in this county, and it's evident by the fact that we have a planning department, and it's the largest planning department in the state of California, I understand, even though we're one of the smallest counties in the state of California.
What's wrong with this picture?
There's a lot wrong with that picture.
And yet, of course, they're telling us how poor they are. My goodness, oh, Mike, we're going to have to lay off policemen and firemen, but we would never think of laying off anybody from the planning department.
No, it just grows and grows. And as part of the planning that they're doing, they plan these very high-density projects that are going to be built along the rail lines. So if you have property that is on the rail line, watch out, because if this Measure J passes, the first thing that's going to happen is that some of your land is going to be condemned to build the rail trail, because that's what part of the money is going to go for in Measure J. And once that land gets condemned, it's pretty easy to condemn your whole parcel, because maybe you are living in a place where they want to build one of these high-density projects. And because it will be considered redevelopment, it won't have to go through our County Board of Supervisors. It'll be a zoning change that the Planning Commission is going to make.
And maybe they'll just simply condemn your land and turn it over to one of their friends, the developers. And this is, of course, what always happens, the very close relationship between people in the Planning Commission on the Board of Supervisors and their friends who help support them to get them elected. We'll be right back here. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening is Susan McLaughlin. We're talking about here in the Santa Cruz, Monterey Bay area, something called Measure J, which is a scam being sold to the people here. Oh, it's only going to be a 0.5% increase in the sales tax, but it's going to go on for 30 years, and we're going to raise $500 million, and we're going to widen the highways and decrease congestion. But the truth of the matter is, they're not going to decrease congestion. They're going to put this in actually to increase congestion, because you're not going to be allowed to get in those new lanes that they're putting in. If you read the small print, you're not going to be in those lanes unless maybe you're driving a bus, or you're driving an emergency vehicle, or you're in a carpool. So what this is really all about, of course, is to allay the public apprehension, to make them think something is going to be done. But in the final analysis, they really intend to put in 10,000 new homes to produce so much congestion, people will just give up and give up their cars. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. If you're out across America and you're running into similar problems, let us know. Certainly here in Santa Cruz, we have one of the most radical planning commissions, radical board of supervisors, radical city councils, any place in the entire nation. A small group of very well-organized people took over control of Santa Cruz 30 years ago under the auspices of Tom Hayden, who I wouldn't say was a communist. I would say that, well, he's about as close as you can get to one, however. And, of course, these same policies are here, and of course, they are going to create more and more and more problems. Their ultimate goal is to get us out of our cars, eventually to limit our ability to have water, to ration water, to force people into these high-density areas where they can be watched and monitored and controlled, because this is all about control.
Yes, and you'll find out that the high-density projects that they are approving right now, they are not approving enough parking spaces for those projects. So if you go to live in one, you may have to give up your car because there will be no place to park it.
Well, let's go to Will, who's calling us from Missouri. Hi, Will.
Hi, Will.
Dan. Hello, Susan. I've got a question for you in regards to this Measure J. I've got a map of California out in front of me here. What is the southerly and the northerly limits of that extension?
All right. Basically, do you want to tell? Go ahead, Susan.
The lane additions are going to go just south of what we call the Fishhook, which is the Highway 17, Highway 1 interchange.
Okay.
Down to San Andreas Road, which is just north of the Watsonville city limits.
Okay. So that's about a 15-mile run there.
A little less than that, but yeah, it's about right.
And so they're only intending to put in high-occupancy vehicle lanes for 15 miles between Watsonville and Santa Cruz?
Right.
That's right. So if you get to the end, either end of that lane increase, you will be forced back into the two lanes again.
But you will be only in the two lanes anyway at any time when there's a high density, in other words, during rush hours.
Is there a tremendous amount of commuter traffic between Watsonville and Santa Cruz?
It is increasing yearly. Watsonville is one of the cities that has adopted this very high-density infill development, and they are increasing their population enormously.
During the rush hours, many times it's just bumper to bumper, especially during the summertime when we have a tremendous influx of tourists, because we have one of the most beautiful strips of land. I don't know if you know this area well, but we've got beaches, we've got redwood trees, we've got the Monterey Bay, we've got the Monterey Bay Sanctuary. This is a lovely place to live. So people come here and they just but you get there during rush hour and it's bumper to bumper, and that's why people, some foolish people, may very well vote for Measure J, because they never read the fine print. It's not going to allow us common folks to use those extra lanes.
Well, it doesn't seem to make very much sense because of the short span of it, but are they planning to have large parking lots in Watsonville and Santa Cruz for the commuters to get together in their carpools?
Yes, they will have those, and of course they will not only have that, but what they really want you to do is park your car and take the bus.
That's right. And are they going to do employer group incentive there for bus passes?
I'm sure they do. They do that already. They also have carpool week for the people who drive into the Silicon Valley from here on Highway 17. They do, and in fact, some of the Measure J funds will go to those kinds of programs.
The whole idea is to get people out of their cars.
Surely. I understand that, Dr. Stan. And when I was living in Seattle, which I did for many years, they introduced these high-occupancy lanes and buses, bus lanes. And at first it didn't seem to make any sense, but it was amazing how rapidly people converted over into carpools. And then it does give an opportunity for the people that don't mind that, especially people that work at the same location or in the neighborhoods, to actually commute together and whatnot. And it did seem to reduce it. But on the days when there was just a tremendous crush of traffic, having sat in the tremendous crush of traffic, there didn't seem like there was nearly quite enough carpools going by to justify that lane sitting there. And so what happened was an enormous number of people would just finally bail out, get into that lane, and then get a ticket about a mile later. So
It felt it was well worth it just so that they could keep moving.
Well, anything on a day when it's that bad. But I think on a 15-mile venture like that, my idea would be to try and debunk their plan based on the short duration and try and see whether or not you could get Citizens Initiative going to to block the project if you haven't already, but then certainly to pass questionnaires around on both ends and get a census of how many people would actually be interested in the program. But I wish you the best of luck, and it sounds like a dreadful program to me.
Thanks very much, Will. Let's go to Roger, who's calling from Nevada. Hi, Roger. How are you doing?
Doing just fine, Dr. Stanley. You have a very, very good program tonight. They're basically trying to do the same stuff out here in Clark County and here Las Vegas, Nevada, trying to get people off the roads, too. About a month ago, I got like a survey from my employer from Citizens Area Transit. They asked like how many miles we travel to and from work. What they're trying to do is they're trying to put everybody to mass public transit will not work in this area.
You know, a really scary thing is in my commute once a few years ago, I got a questionnaire in the mail asking me about my commute over Highway 17, and I wondered how the county knew I was driving over there every day. Well, they took a picture of my license plate, and then they looked me up and sent me a questionnaire.
Yeah, that's what they have out here, too. They also have a lot of cameras on the freeways and also the city streets out here, and they're doing the same thing out here in Nevada also. It's pretty scary. They're trying to take away all of our freedoms.
They really are.
But yes. You see, these planners really believe that they're so much smarter. This is, of course, an elitist program to use these various incentives to control and manipulate the people. They're not interested in serving the people. They're not interested in solving the problems. They're interested in creating the problems so they can get more control over our lives. When you understand that, it all makes sense.
It sure does, Dr. Stan.
And I think we all need to know that that's a big difference from even 30 or 40 years ago when we elected people to office. They were there to serve us. And nowadays, they're there. They want to be elected because they don't want to serve us. They want to tell us what to do.
They want to control us, right.
Also, I got another question, Dr. Stan. I heard something over in California. They're trying to tighten up the EPA emission standards for your emissions. They're basically trying to do that here in Nevada. They're trying to wipe out cars where they can't even pass them anymore.
That's what it's all about. They're using this whole emission scam, air pollution, to justify getting us out of our cars. And, of course, for years they would say, well, we look at how terrible the gas is, the smog is, say, down in the Los Angeles basin, and there really is, this is an inversion basin, and they really did have a smog problem. But the major part of the smog came from the diesel trucks. And yet anybody who suggested that they get the diesel trucks off the road or do something to the diesel engines to cut down on the smog was immediately attacked and belittled, and I know this happened to me. When I suggested that black soot coming out of the tailpipe of the diesel trucks was causing smog, oh, you don't understand why. We have degrees, we've taken these university courses. That isn't smog. Let us define smog for you. They did this for 20 years. While, of course, they use their power to, cut down emission from cars. And we have the cleanest air really in the entire world in most of the parts here in California. And now they suddenly come up and said, why, the major cause of smog is diesel. Now we've got to control that. So what they did is they preserved the problem so they could use it to justify controlling the car manufacturers. And then once they did that, they stopped lying and they admitted that the real cause of so much of the pollution was diesel. So we have to understand that these people are not honest. And how do you deal with people who are not honest?
Well, hopefully you vote them out of office.
Right.
Yeah, and also to make sure you control them financially also and don't donate any money to them also.
That's right. Don't vote for things like Measure J.
All right. Anything else you wanted to say there, Roger?
Yeah, absolutely. You nailed that right on the forehead.
Okay.
Very, very good show, and God bless you guys.
I do just
want to get the word out.
Do you listen to Lou Epton there and over there in Las Vegas?
No, I don't hear him too much.
He does a pretty good job. Lou's a nice guy. I was on with him earlier this week. Got a good response there in Las Vegas from doing the program. Hey, thanks so much for calling, Roger.
Yes, thank you so much, Dr. Stanley. Have a nice evening. God bless you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You too. Okay, well, our telephone number again is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. Our guest is Susan McLaughlin. We're talking about Measure J here in Santa Cruz, an effort to, of course, to put in the sales tax to get money to widen the highway. But, of course, they're not going to allow us common folks to use those lanes. It's only, of course, the carpools, the emergency vehicles, the buses. So it's not going to really solve the problem at all. It all has to do with control. how they will control the people to get them to do what they want them to. Why not put in two extra lanes on either side? Because they don't really want to solve the problem.
That's
they
right.
want the problem so they can control us. That's what it's about.
Yes, part of the problem with widening the highway here in Highway 1 in Santa Cruz County is the fact that we have 8 or 9 overpasses that could accommodate maybe an extra lane, but they can't accommodate 2 extra lanes. And our own Transportation Commission in 1986 said we needed to have 4 lanes in each direction by 2005 if we were going to accommodate the growth here in the county. So even if they do add an extra lane by not modifying the overpasses and allowing for even more growth, we're going to be stuck in the same situation by the time they get the lanes added. And by the way, we haven't mentioned this, but it's going to take 20 years to get these lanes added to the freeway. So even though you will start paying now, you will not see any additional lanes on the freeway for a very long time.
And I'm sure that the people in positions of power will do everything they can to block getting anything done, as they have for the last 30 years. They've
That's
blocked
right.
this consistently. The state would have put this in a long time ago. They would have paid for it. They didn't want this. They blocked this. They blocked this. They've done everything they could. And now they're going to add 10,000 new homes here to create total traffic chaos. They know exactly what they're doing. They just don't want the public to know.
I actually attended a transportation meeting about 6 years ago on the very topic of widening the highway, and there were transportation engineers there from Caltrans. They had done multiple plans over the last 10 years, each time trying to accommodate what the local politicians wanted, and each time their plan was shut down. And one of the things that they have done to delay the building of the additional lanes on the highway is to take money that was delegated for that purpose and do studies. And they have spent millions of dollars on different kinds of studies, probably a lot of times to study how to get you out of your car rather than spend the money on the lanes. And this is extremely wasteful. And in 1986, the Santa Cruz Transportation Commission actually stated their highest priority was to widen Highway 1. That was in 1986. Now, can you imagine an organization whose highest priority to do something has taken them almost 20 years, 15 years, to even start to talk about doing? You can imagine that the 20 years from now, that those lanes aren't going to be there, that they're going to find ways to spend money on studies, to delay the construction, and in fact, the construction is going to be another way to discourage you, to make your traveling so painful that you won't travel.
And, you know, I think that this whole, you mentioned the studies, we see this with the water districts. They spent hundreds of thousands of dollars instead of trying to solve the problem, having another study that is going to study the study that they finished studying. And they do this intentionally, and they do this with all sorts of government agencies. Why? To waste the money, because they don't want to solve the problem. The problem is how they're able to extend their control over our lives. And if you solve the problem, then they wouldn't be able to control us. So
yeah.
This is what they do, and you'll see this over and over again. Another couple of $100,000 for the study, and then there's no money to solve the problem.
Well, we have seen that over and over with the Highway 1 expansion and the modification of the Highway 17, Highway 1 interchange.
But, of course, we've seen this all as far as our water boards are concerned and so many of our other boards and so many of our other commissions, and they have the money which they get from our taxes, and then, of course, they spend it fabulous amounts, you know, on these extensive studies, and they're, you know, about 3 or 4 inches thick, and it's got all this highfalutin language, and it doesn't say anything at all, and it is not, because if they did not spend the money there, people might ask why they weren't trying to solve the problem.
Yeah.
They don't want to solve the problem, and until we understand that, we can't understand what's going on today. They want to raise the price of electricity. They want to raise the price of natural gas. They want to raise the price of oil. They want to raise the price of water. And they're going to get away with it unless the people get involved, understand what's happening, and stand together and get responsible people into office. And whenever anybody tries to run who is responsible, you can be sure that this, most of the local newspapers and the major newspapers will attack and vilify them and do everything they can to make their lives miserable.
Well, I think the people of Santa Cruz County have to be courageous. This is a very important election coming up. The decision about Measure J is going to have a very important impact on our county. Now, if it fails, if it doesn't pass, in other words, if we successfully convince you that you should vote no on it, it doesn't mean that the highway will never be widened, because I'm sure you could bring in engineers in and have it done in a year if you wanted to, if the people of Santa Cruz County wanted to have it done. So rather than leave our fate in the hands of people who don't care anything about us, it's really important that we go and vote on Tuesday and make sure that this measure doesn't pass. I feel if this measure passes, it is a turning point for Santa Cruz County for the worse than it is now.
And, of course, these people will have all this additional money to buy support so they can continue their power structure. And, of course, I want to starve them as far as the money is concerned.
Yes.
Get responsible people in office who really want to widen the lanes and want to do what's right to solve our problems here rather than compound the problems exactly as they're doing. Well, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here on the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. And if you look around in your communities out across America, you're going to find exactly the same thing is happening. They want to tear down the dams. We've got to protect the fishies. They want, of course, to put meters on the wells. Why, my goodness, we can't have people stealing money from the aquifer. They want, of course, areas around all of the streams. We don't want you contaminating the streams. What they really want to control your property, what they really want to do is control you. We'll be back here in just a moment to wrap up the program here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and we've got Phil calling from Michigan. Hi, Phil. How are you doing?
Dr. Stan, just marvelous. The property rights issue here is really one of understanding how exactly the government acquires legal jurisdiction over one's property. And unfortunately, people have failed to make the connection that when they record their property deed, even though there is no law, at least here in Michigan, there's no law requiring the recordation of the property deed. Once you do, you lose all legal rights and interest in it, because now the government becomes the holder in due course of that deed of title, and that's according to the Uniform Commercial Code. It's a body codified of private merchant law, and the solution is to ultimately, through paperwork, simply secure away from them the holder in due course secured party.
Well, maybe sometime you could just write that up and get it to us. I'm sure there are ways of doing it. You certainly want to get back to alluvial deeds and things like that, but this gets pretty complicated, and we're just about out of time. Did you have a quick question? Because we're just about ready to let Susan go.
Well, my only question, I would want to confer with Susan sometime just to give her the precise information.
All right, fine. Well, maybe you could send
That'd
it to
great.
Me as well. But thank you so much for calling, Phil. And I want to thank Susan so very much for being with us here at Radio
Well,
Radio.
I appreciate the opportunity.
And we hope people will take a second look. They'll read the small print on Measure J. It really sounds good. I want to see the highway widen. I think Susan wants to see the highway widen. But do you really trust these people who are in positions of power now to do what's right?
Well, considering that the Empire State Building was built in 1 year, and they're planning to take 20 years to add a couple of lanes to a freeway, I think that the answer to whether or not Measure J should be voted in or not is right there.
I agree with you totally. Thank you so very much. Now, Susan is with Freedom 21 Santa Cruz. You want to get your website out there for us?
Yes. The website is www.freedom21santacruz.net. And Freedom 21 Santa Cruz is all one word. And we have a phone number. You can call us at 831-684-2232. We've got a lot of information. We've got articles you can use. We have case studies that we've done. There's a lot of original material on the website that can help you decide and discern what is going on in the world today.
All right, well, thank you so very much for being with us. Our guest has been Susan McLaughlin. He's done a lot of work and a lot of study. She works with Freedom 21 Santa Cruz. Go to the website. You'll learn a lot there. Good night. God bless you.
Good night.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and we're going to sort of, if you get your pencil and paper out there, let me tell you that they've done it again. They've changed our shortwave frequencies, but they've waited till the last day, so we wouldn't have much time
to tell people.
As of Monday, this program that you're listening to will be on this evening program, 8 to 10 Pacific, 11 to 1 on the East Coast, will be on two shortwave frequencies. The first is Angel 1. It will be at 7.535, just like you're listening to. The second transmitter, however, which, of course, we told you was going to go to 6.095, forget it. For the first hour, that is from 8 to 9 Pacific time, it will be at 5.835. For the second hour, from 9 to 10, or on the East Coast, from midnight to 1 o'clock, will be at 5.970. That, of course, from 7.315 will change to 5.835. That's from 8 to 9. And 9 to 10 will be at 5.970. Our afternoon program, if you listen to us on afternoon, will go from 9.430 to 7.535. So you can listen at 7.535 both afternoon and evening to shortwave. Please tell others about this. I mean, it's maddening that they wait until just the last minute to tell us. So, of course, we don't have a chance to get to everybody who's listening on a regular basis. But please do everything you can to put the word out to other people and mention it on other radio stations if you can. Because, of course, we want to keep our people listening. We have a growing shortwave audience, but these frequencies will supposedly remain in place until March of next year, March 26th, when we go back to where we were before. Under any circumstances, remember this program, you can either pick it up at 7.535 or for the first hour at 5.835, the second hour at 5.970. Almost looks like we have friends in Washington, D.C. who are making our lives miserable. I'm sure, though, however, it's aimed at giving us the best frequency that's available for coverage in the United States. Well, we certainly want to, of course, remind all of our listeners that Radio Liberty is having a all-day seminar a week from tomorrow. That's the 6th of November. It's going to start you ought to be there by 8:15 or 8:30, 8:15 if you can get there. We'll start promptly at 8:45, go straight on through till 5 in the evening. We're bringing in outside speakers, great speakers. You're going to learn a great deal and begin to understand how this all fits together. Michael Shaw is going to be speaking. He's the chairman of Freedom 21 Santa Cruz. Bill Sardi, one of our favorite guests, is going to be there. Joe Schimmel is going to be there. He's going to be talking for a couple of hours, and you'll be fascinated. He's got one of the most amazing talks I've ever heard, and will really help you to understand the true nature of the battle in which we're engaged in. In fact, he is the man who put together the videos. They sold their souls for rock and roll, the 4 or the 10-hour version. However, you're only going to have a couple of hours this Saturday. So if you'd like to come, we have to have your reservations in this weekend. We have to let them know early on Monday how many people are coming. So if you're planning on coming, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927 for the all-day Radio Liberty Seminar. And, of course, we'll be back here in just a couple of minutes with the next hour of our program. For our listeners up in the Great Northwest, let me just simply mention that they are having the Institutes of the Constitution there. And if you're interested, you can call John at 509-326-0171. That's 509-326-0171. Or Neil at 509-891-7428. That's 509-891-7428. Please pray for America. Pray for revival, because if this country doesn't turn back to God, we're going to lose America. And lastly, pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. Until Monday, when we'll be back with you again, Dr. Stan, good night, and May the Lord be with you. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that will determine what the future will bring. I need to remind you that views are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being. We have with us on the line, Susan McDunn, and we're going to be talking about judicial decisions. Susan, thank you so much for being with us.
Good evening.
Would you like to sort of introduce yourself to our listeners so they'll know who you are?
Yes. My name is Judge Susan McDunn. I'm a judge in the, of the Circuit Court of Cook County. That's in the Chicagoland area, Chicago and the metropolitan area. And I am up for retention this November on the ballot. And what's going on with my life right now is I am being aggressively opposed in this retention election by some groups who disagree with some rulings I made in two adoption cases that I heard in 1998 involving petitions by lesbian couples to adopt children.
Mm-hmm. All right, fine. So they are being then attacked, for, sort of vilified because of your decision.
That's right.
All right. Well, of course, you probably had an awful lot of decisions, though, that were very favorable to a lot of people. How long have you been a circuit judge there in Cook County?
I've been sitting as a judge in Cook County for 11 years.
I see. Well, that must be an exciting place then. Of course, Cook County at one time was sort of the center of a lot of the mafia and other activities. Is it pretty tame there at the present time?
It's a very nice city to live in, a very nice area to live in. Yes, it's nothing like those days.
All right, fine. Well, why don't you tell us, what the simply spending a lot of money and opposing you, and how are they impacting on your chance for re-election? Are they running somebody against you actively?
No, what it is I am not actually running against anyone. Everyone who runs for retention in Cook County runs on their record, and you do not have an opponent. And what you do need to do, though, is get 60% of the votes that are cast in the election, and you're not having any actual candidate against you. But many groups are spending a lot of money on advertisements and constantly reporting negative things in the newspapers, all of which are false against me, because they oppose the rulings that I made. And the rulings that I made were just what I was obligated to do under the law. I was upholding the law, and they didn't like the law. And were resisting me all through the cases and continuing much long afterwards, for many years afterwards, up till today. And what happened was these cases came before me, and the law required me to hold a hearing to consider all the evidence that existed on the issue of whether the adoptions were in the best interest of the children. And the petitioners in the case and the guardian in the case and everybody else who's opposing me, they wanted the adoptions approved automatically without even any type of court hearing at all. And the law did not allow for that, and I, against strong opposition, steadfastly upheld the children's rights to those hearings.
Well, of course, you're obligated as an officer of the court to do what is stipulated, by the law. And so how could they possibly object to your doing what was your legal duty to do?
Well, it isn't politically correct here in this area, even though it was the law in Illinois, and the other judges were not holding hearings, and I was new to the division.
Hold that thought right there. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening is Susan McDunn, who sees a sitting circuit court judge in the Chicago area in Cook County, and she has a website. It's www.judgesusanmcdunn.com, and will people find part of your story up there on your website?
Yes, I have a summary of the story. I have information regarding my background and qualifications, and I have also more detailed information on there about these cases.
All
what
right,
actually
so.
Happened was allegations were made against me regarding these cases even after the cases were over, and these allegations were all false, and they eventually became part of a complaint against me, which was fully litigated and resolved completely in my favor. It was dismissed with prejudice, which means it was totally final. And the Illinois Courts Commission found that the allegations they were making against me had no basis at all and were completely without merit. And copies of those Illinois Courts Commission opinions supporting me are on my website. And one is a 10-page opinion on behalf of the entire commission. And then there's also an additional 6-page opinion by one of the commissioners that he wrote on his own behalf, and those can be reviewed on the website.
Well, now, of course, has this been covered thoroughly in the media, or is there a certain amount of a bias within the media against you?
Well, there is a very strong bias in the media against me, and these groups that are opposing me, they are reporting their view of things to the newspapers, and the newspapers report it, and they call me usually the day before they're going to write an article, and I talk to them, but then what happens is they just print the allegations and then maybe one sentence that I say, and sometimes that's not even quoted correctly. So my story isn't getting out. The allegations just keep being repeated and repeated, even though they're the same allegations from 1998 that were proven to and found to have been without any basis. So they're making allegations that the Courts Commission already found were without any basis, and the press keeps printing it and repeating it as well.
Well, Judge, the trouble is that if you read something often enough, it doesn't matter how ridiculous it is, people eventually will come to believe it. And one of the big problems we have is a freedom of the press is not necessarily the ability to print what's right, but what the owners want printed. Well, our guest this evening is Judge Susan McDunn, and she's a sitting judge there in Cook County in Chicago. And, of course, she has been obviously targeted by certain groups who didn't like the fact that she would not, she upheld the law. She would not bend to go along with the pressure groups, and there are groups out there that will target anybody who stands against them. I know this happened. happened to me one time because of a video that I did, and I was targeted, and let me tell you that they made our life just as miserable as they could for many, many months. thousands, well, at least hundreds of obscene telephone calls on a regular basis to actually try to demoralize us. And have you had that sort of treatment as well?
I haven't had any harassing phone calls or anything like that, but yes, my life has been made very difficult, and I've had to deal with much unfairness and injustice myself, personally.
Well, of course, the thing is, are you getting any support from your fellow judges? In other words, do the other judges see what's happening, or are they more or less afraid to speak out?
Well, judges generally don't speak out on behalf of other judges. But in this retention election, there are 75 or so judges up for retention. One-third of the Cook County Judiciary, of the elected Cook County Judiciary, is up for retention in any given year. And there is a committee for retention of judges that supports retention of all judges. But no, judges generally do not speak out on the cases of a fellow judge, at least not publicly.
Well, now, of course, if you're not getting a fair shake in the as far as the newspaper is concerned, how can you get your side out to the public?
Well, it's very difficult, and also it's very difficult in the mainstream press. It's very difficult, and this is why I'm talking, doing things like this, talking on radio programs, and this is why I made my website, because I'm trying to get the truth out to the people who want to know the truth and who want to understand what really has taken place.
Well, I know we have listeners there right in the Chicago area, so I hope that they will go to your website. That's www.judgesusanmcdunn.com. That's judgesusanmcdunn.com. And I know how difficult it is when people say things like that, and you really can't get your side of the story out. I've been there myself. I ran for Congress a couple of times, and I will tell you that it's very, very disheartening when you realize, of course, you're not going to get a fair shake from my point of view, anyway, from any of the newspapers.
Mm-hmm. And what made it especially difficult, and what is especially difficult for judges generally, is that in this case, when all the misinformation start being spread about, that was still when the cases were pending. And when cases are pending, a judge, under judicial rules, is prohibited from publicly commenting on the cases. So the parties may start talking about the cases, but the judge may not. So that was part of the problem, how all this false information started being disseminated and accepted, is only one version was going out there. I couldn't comment. No one could talk to me about it. And also, what further complicated it, all the parties in the case were all on one side. In normal lawsuits, there's always two sides. It's an adversarial system, and there's one side against the other side. But often with adoptions, and it's usually the case with adoptions, you have the petitioners and a guardian, and that's all. And if the guardian agrees with the petitioners, which was the case here, they both said it was in the best interest of the children, and they objected to any hearing at all. There's no other side to defend the court's rulings. So when they start spreading false information about the cases when the cases were still pending, I couldn't talk about it, and there was nobody else in the case to defend my rulings or to challenge any inaccuracies that were being reported by the petitioners or the guardians. And then further complicating it was that in adoption cases, the files, the court files, are sealed. So nobody could check the court files to see if things were true that were being said. And I had written detailed orders explaining all my rulings, and there were transcripts of all the court hearings, but no one could see them.
Well, no,
yet,
even today.
Yet the press went ahead and published everything that they said, and they universally condemned me as being guilty of these allegations when there was no way for them to verify if they were true.
And now this was, of course, in the media you're talking about.
Right, in the press.
Well, now, what about today? Are you allowed to talk about this?
I'm allowed to talk about it because I'm running for retention, and when we run for retention, we're running on our record. So we're free. Well, we're campaigning to defend our record, so I'm free to talk about what occurred in these cases and try to get the record straight. But what's really unfair is that these people are raising the same allegations that were fully litigated, and that is not even coming out clearly in the press.
I see. Well, are you at liberty at all to talk about what the issues are? Or would you
Yes, I am.
Well, why don't you go ahead?
But before I go into that, I'll just clarify what I can't talk about, and that is, that I don't talk about. There are, because of judicial rules in Illinois, I do not comment on my personal beliefs regarding disputed legal, social, or political issues, and that is because as judges we have a duty to uphold the law regardless of our personal beliefs. So our personal beliefs are really irrelevant, and we have a duty to conduct ourselves in a way that will promote confidence in the integrity and impartiality of the judiciary. And anything that I say is not a commitment by me, or and should not be construed as a commitment by me to rule in the future in any certain way on any issue or case.
Well,
so we're supposed to emphasize that, but having done that, I can now tell you what actually happened in the case.
All right, why don't you go ahead and tell us what happened.
Okay, well, the cases came before me in 1998, and I was new to the division, and I believe it was July of 1998. I got two separate cases simultaneously presented to me, both involving lesbian couples seeking to adopt children. And the children were the biological child of, in each case, the children were the biological children of one of the petitioners, and the other woman was seeking to adopt as a co-parent. And I ordered the best interest hearings. The petitioners and the guardians strongly objected because they contended I should just automatically approve them with no hearing, because nobody was objecting, and because the guardian was stating that it was in the best interest of the children. And his position was that I should just approve it because he said so, basically. And his other ground for me approving it was that all the other judges in the division routinely approve these adoptions. And he said that at that time they receive about 60 adoptions like that a year. And he was the same guardian appointed in every case. He had an office behind the courtroom, and that's who was appointed as a guardian in every case, so he would know those numbers.
But, of course, wouldn't the, if the child was the child of a lesbian, wouldn't she be the guardian of the child?
No, the parents, the biological parent files the petition along with the person that wants to be the co-parent.
All right,
and then a guardian is appointed, and it's his duty to represent the best interests of the children. In other words, the petitioner's interests, which includes the biological mother and the additional woman who wants to be a co-parent, their interests are separate. The law recognizes that their interests are separate, possibly, than the interests of the child. They want to adopt this child. But the question for the court is, is this in the best interest of the child to be adopted by these petitioners?
Well, I thought that the biological mother of the child, doesn't she speak for the child, or doesn't she have the right to the child?
Well, the biological mother in normal everyday affairs has the right to speak for the child and make decisions for the child, of course, just like any parent. But it's the same situation with any adoptions. If you have a, for instance, if you had somebody that was married once and had a child, and then say their spouse died, and now they're remarrying, the one person would be the biological parent, and now the new spouse might want to adopt the child. In Illinois, the way the Adoption Act is written, if you're going to have two people, if there's going to be an adoption and there's two people, like two married people, both people have to be named in the adoption petition as the petitioners. And the adoption is only approved, can only be approved if the court finds it's in the best interest of the child. So, you see, the petitioners, they may have their own reasons why they want to adopt this child or have the child. Now, the biological parents, the biological parent is named as one of the petitioners, the biological parents' rights are not affected in any way. I mean, before the adoption is filed, they are the biological parent and have parental rights. And regardless of whether the adoption gets approved or not, they continue to be the parent and have parental rights. But the law just requires that if there's going to be a second parent, that a second person that wants to be made a parent of this child legally, that the biological parent has to join in the petition.
All right, we'll be back here in just a moment with Judge Susan McDunn, and we'll, of course, try to understand why there's this tremendous opposition simply because she asked for a hearing. And we'll be back in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening is Judge Susan McDunn, and we're talking about this case, the two cases that have given her so much problem. Well, eventually, of course, you held the hearings, and of course, was it that what was decided at the hearings? Was it the decision made that these people had the right then to adopt or not?
Well, I didn't actually ever hold the hearings because I wasn't permitted to. Another judge intervened in the cases, and I contend it was wrongfully so, and they were violating the law by going to this other judge, but that is what ultimately occurred. And I was not permitted to even finish the cases or hold the hearings, and the other judge vacated my orders and approved the adoptions without holding any court hearing at all. And that is the ultimate result of the cases, but they still weren't happy with that. They still have been...
Well, it seems to me like it's almost like a vendetta against you because you wanted to uphold the law. What about what was done to the other judge who illegally took the cases and negated or vacated your orders?
Well, he was fine. He was affirmed on appeal. They ended up, because I contended he did not have legal authority to be entering orders in my cases, and it was inconsistent with the then existing law, my position was when a judge does not have legal authority to enter an order, those orders are void. It's called lack of jurisdiction, and the effect of that is that it's a void order, which means it's a nullity. And so, when he started entering orders in my cases, I analyzed that, and the conclusion was that those orders were of no effect, and so therefore that meant I had a continuing duty in the cases, and I needed to proceed in the cases and fulfill my obligation to hold these hearings. So I continued to enter orders saying that these hearings were going to go ahead, and that, of course, made the parties more angry, and... Then they ran back to this other judge, and eventually the other judge told them that they would have to file a motion for a supervisory order with the Illinois Supreme Court to ask them to enter an order directing or clarifying whose orders were going to stand. And that was the proper procedure they should have followed. He did give them the right direction on that, though they shouldn't have been appearing before him because they were my cases. But instead of doing that, they returned back to him about a week later, and they asked him to stay my orders because they wanted to file an appeal to the Illinois Appellate Court. And he immediately told them that wasn't the right procedure and that isn't what he told them to do. And then he quickly after that backtracked and said, oh, wait, maybe I'm overlooking something. And he did end up staying my orders so they could appeal. And even the staying of my orders was improper because if you're going to appeal a judge's orders, you go to that judge and ask that judge to stay their orders while you appeal them. But they were just totally ignoring me because they didn't like my rulings. And like I said, they were able to get away with this because of the fact that a judge can't comment on a pending case There was no opposition in their case. They were the, there was only one side in the case, and the files were sealed. So nobody knew what really was going on except them, and they could represent whatever they wanted, and they were making accusations to the press and everyone else that I wasn't following the law and that I was wrong.
Hold that thought for just a moment, Judge. Well, this is Dr. Stan. So then, of course, isn't there a judicial review system that would, of course, take the other judge to task for violating ethics, judicial ethics?
Well, that's what you would think should happen, and the unfortunate thing is that that wasn't the case.
Well,
and
did you take, take this to a judicial review on that specific issue, in other words, for his intervening when he shouldn't have?
Well, the thing is that everybody was in alignment on the same, with the same thinking, and everybody was support, all the people in power were supporting all of this type of behavior, even though it wasn't consistent with an existing law. And I did not get any fair hearing until after the cases were over and a complaint was filed against me, that I finally got, you know, a hearing where I could directly, where they had to put on paper their allegations, and then I would respond in paper, and then there was an oral argument. You know, we both did lengthy, extensive briefing on these issues, and that was the first opportunity I had for a fair hearing, because, see, my opponents could not be running behind my back and talking to the courts commissioners who were going to decide the issue. You see what I'm saying? All the other time, they just would run to the newspapers, run to other judges and talk to them. But finally, when I had my hearing, now we had a formal proceeding, and they wouldn't be permitted to be talking to the courts commissioners who were going to be deciding this. And they had to put down on paper the allegations they were making. They couldn't be making allegations behind my back.
Well,
so I responded in writing, and then finally I was vindicated as being, having done nothing wrong. But you see, the appellate court had already affirmed the adoptions, and the courts commission had the power to decide whether the accusations against me were valid or not, which basically they were alleging that I was biased, and their allegations were based solely on my rulings that they disagreed with. In other words, they said she made this order, she did it because she was biased. And there was no factual basis for it, except they disagree with rulings, which is no basis for any kind of bias charges. A U.S. Supreme Court case that says bias can almost never be based upon a judge's rulings. Because if you disagree with a ruling, you appeal it, and then the appellate court has the authority to either, you know, affirm it or reverse the order.
All right. Well, now, of course, that must have cost them a fair amount of money. Where did they get the money? You don't simply take a case like this to court and bring charges against a judge. You got to pay lawyers to do this. This is going to be terribly expensive for them,
well,
wasn't it?
Well, the complaint was filed actually by a board called the Judicial Inquiry Board. After the petitioners and the guardian got the adoptions approved and it was affirmed by the appellate court, they or somebody who was against me went to the Judicial Inquiry Board, which is the body that people go to when they want to make a complaint against a judge, and they made a complaint alleging that I was biased, that I made rulings in these cases because of my personal beliefs and my bias. But the truth was that I was just upholding the law, and everything I did was obligated by law.
But of course, you weren't going to make the decision. You were going to hold the hearing, and based upon the evidence that came out at the hearing,
right,
that would be the decision.
That's right.
You hadn't made a decision one way or the other, I assume.
Right, but they were angry just that I was going to hold a hearing. And so, see, they make, when someone makes a complaint against a judge, they make it with the Judicial Inquiry Board, and then they do an investigation, and if they decide to, they file the complaint, and then the Judicial Inquiry Board is in effect the plaintiff and the judge is the respondent, and that's what took place.
Now, did
but
you have to have a lawyer defend yourself, or did you
yes,
defend
I did.
Yourself?
And that was my own personal expense. My own personal expense to do that, too.
Well, now, of course, can you bring any sort of counter charges against the people who brought unwarranted charges against you?
Okay, well, as to that, I don't I don't want to comment on that.
All right, fine.
Okay.
But, I mean, would you have the legal right to do that if you wanted to? I won't ask if you did it, but does a judge have any ability to defend themselves against unwarranted things in a theoretical case, not in this one at all?
Mm-hmm.
All right, fine. So, anyway, of course, I think that somebody's gone to a great deal of effort to actually discredit you and make your life miserable. Would that be a fair statement?
That's true. That's true.
All right, we're going to be back here in just a moment. If you're out there in the listening audience, you have a question for Judge McDunn, why, give us a call. Again, that's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And, you know, of course, the judicial system is the very foundation of our society. In fact, if you go back and you read 1 Samuel, the 8th chapter, it was when the judicial system in ancient Israel became corrupt, that of course they lost the freedom and they got a king who would rule over them. And if people were moral and responsible, why, we wouldn't need kings, but you have to have a judicial system that is above a reproach. We'll be back in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening is Judge Susan McDunn. And Judge McDunn, of course, is on the front lines of a battle now, struggling for her re-election. How often do you have to be re-elected, stand for re-election here in the Chicago area?
Every 6 years.
All right. So as you've won for two times around, and now, of course, you've been more or less targeted. There are people who really, of course, want to get at you because, you just wanted to abide by the law. It would appear that an awful lot of the judges are willing to sort of go around that because they don't want to be controversial. Would that be a fair statement, or would you just as soon not comment on that?
Well, I'd rather not comment on
right,
what their motivations would be, except to say that it's very easy when you're hearing something like an adoption where you have a duty to determine the best interest and nobody is objecting, to just not think about it and kind of go along and not really realize that you're not, you know, doing what the law requires if nobody's objecting. Because most lawsuits, as I said, there's a plaintiff and a defendant and they're going to be making their arguments. But in cases involving children, the court has an especially high duty. We have a responsibility to look out after their best interests. And there's an Illinois case that says that even if nobody in the case raises an objection, the court has a duty to raise issues and defenses even if they're not raised by a party. And this is what was partly wrong with the guardian's thinking. He was used to the judges doing what he said. And if he said it was in the best interest, the judges disapproved it. But that's not what the law is. The law doesn't say that a judge should approve the adoption if the guardian says it's in the best interest. The law is that the judge may only approve the adoption if the judge finds it's in the best interest. And the law also provides that the judge has a duty in cases involving children to make sure that any evidence existing on an issue is presented and heard. And that's what I was trying to fulfill. And the fact that his other reason that he thought I should approve the adoptions is that all the other trial judges. And one of the things that they make very unclear in the press is they say, you know, adoptions by homosexuals were legal in Illinois and I was, you know, violating the law. They say that because other trial judges in Cook County, Illinois were approving these adoptions as a matter of course. But that doesn't make it right or make it the law, because each trial judge is bound by Illinois appellate court rulings and state statutes and Illinois Supreme Court rulings. But what we are not bound by what other trial judges do. Each trial judge has independent authority and responsibility to rule in each case before them on the basis of what they believe the law requires. And the fact that other judges might not be following the law is not justification for me as a trial judge to not follow the law.
Okay, we'll be back in just a moment with Judge Susan McDunn. And of course, we'll welcome your calls from out across America. And if you have a question, a comment, our telephone number, 1-888 24 Liberty, or there in the Central Coast of California, where we're located at 464-8295. And Judge McDonough has certainly been targeted because she went by the law. And there are certain groups that will target every people and make their lives miserable. I know I was associated with a number of people some years ago on a very, very similar issue, and every one of them had their lives and their professions destroyed. And how I survived, well, I've always had the feel that maybe the Lord was with me, and that's why I survived and the others didn't. But so many good people lost their professions, were hounded, and many of them, of course, were forced to leave their jobs simply because they took a stand for what they believed was right, dealing with not this exact issue, but certainly similar sort of issues, dealing with the same, well, that's the similar sorts of issues. I will leave it at that. Under any circumstances, Judge, now, of course, right now, of course, you're trying to get the information out by radio. You're not doing too well by, certainly by the newspapers. Is there any way you can run ads in the newspapers? It's probably pretty late for doing it now, isn't it?
Right, it is. I have not run advertisements, no.
All right. And then the question is, how do you reach the people, you know, because power of the press is a mighty thing, and the power of the press should show all sides fairly and evenly, and of course the editorial pages are where you editorialize. Unfortunately, we find increasingly in the papers, pages of the press, rather than you know, being impartial and giving who, what, when, where, and why they craft the articles to project a specific bias, and that really, I think, is unforgivable. And because there's really no way that the average individual can counter that. The power of the press is a mighty power. And
it's
when it's misused, why, freedom certainly it can well be destroyed, not only of an individual, but of an entire society.
It's very difficult, and especially because it's so much easier to throw out accusations. With just one sentence, you can make an accusation. And to explain the truth is usually much more involved. To explain and prove why that statement is false is much more involved, and usually people in newspapers are not going to give you the space to do that. You can make one sentence denying it or stating what the truth is, but you haven't cleared up the perception that maybe you're wrong, because it takes a while to be able to really get into, especially with legal issues, you know, to explain what really was the controlling case law and things like that.
But, I mean, the thing is, this is long over gone by. I mean, this is many years ago. It seems like this is a personal vendetta against you.
They do not want to let go of it. As I said, their adoptions were proved. They never had the hearings that I ordered that they didn't want, and they weren't happy with that. They went to the press, and then even after that, then they wanted an investigation against me, and it took a year and a half for this investigation to go on before any complaint was filed. And then finally there was one filed, and then I had to litigate that. And it was a very unfair and wrong process for me to have to go through, because I was being accused of not following the law when the truth was I was the only one following the law, and many other people were not following the law in many respects. But I patiently and quietly just dealt with it and submitted to the process and the system and focused on, you know, proving my innocence, and I prevailed with that. And then I thought, once I do that, everyone will be satisfied and understand. And instead, after I was vindicated, I felt people were very angry that I was vindicated. And this was really wrong, because it's not respecting the rule of law.
Well, we see that they're not interested in the rule of law. They're interested in getting anybody who dares to take a stand against this specific group. So I know I've seen this over and over again. This is not the first time this has happened, although I know it must be anguish for you.
It is a difficult thing.
And I suppose you really enjoy being a judge there. Certainly, being a judge, certainly, do you do criminal cases, or do you do, what sort of cases do you ordinarily do?
No, my background is in the civil area of the law. I practiced in a large private law firm, one of the most prominent law firms in the nation, before becoming a judge. And as a judge, I have served primarily doing civil matters. And the current assignment that I am in is a civil jury trial room, which I enjoy very much. I enjoy all the variety of dealing with all the different people, the lawyers, the witnesses, and then all the jurors who come from every walk of life and every type of background possible. And it's really an honor and a privilege to be involved in and participate in the administration of justice and to work with all of, you know, my fellow citizens who are jurors, and to see them come together from every type of background and work together to administer justice along with me.
But isn't this really a means of circumventing justice? In other words, to target a judge who's tried to uphold the law, and of course to not only, this is a matter of many years, going after you through the legal system when they couldn't do that, to try to get you, your re-election. Wouldn't this be used as a means of certainly of intimidating all the other judges never to take a stand for what they really believe in, just to go along?
Well, I think that is the case, and I think that's something very unfortunate. But, as judges, we have a duty. One of the judicial ethics rules requires that we uphold the integrity and independence of the judiciary, and that we remain unswayed by partisan interest, public clamor, or fear of criticism. And that's what I did. And the Illinois Courts Commission, in ruling in my favor, pointed that out that I had that duty, and that's what I did, and therefore people can't seek to have a complaint against me because they just disagree with my rulings. Because we have the duty to uphold the law, even if we're going to be criticized or people are going to be disagreeing with it or unhappy with it.
Now, of course, you say you had certainly the judges supported you, and one of the judges wrote an independent opinion. Was that in support of you as well?
Yes. They're both excellent opinions. The opinion that was the opinion issued on behalf of the Courts Commission was issued by the commissioner of the Courts Commission, the chairperson of the Courts Commission, and his name was Justice Robert Thomas, and he is an Illinois Supreme Court justice. And he wrote the main opinion, which is 10 pages long, and it in many ways sets forth much of the law that supported my rulings. And he stated that the commission found that, quote, I was fulfilling my mandated duty of placing the best interests of children above all others, and that was the only bias that they found, a bias towards placing the best interests of children above all others. And he also stated that, quote, a fair reading of Judge McDonough's orders creates a clear impression of a judge conscientiously applying existing law to an unresolved question. What impact does the sexual orientation of the petitioners have on the child's best interests? Judge McDonough's view that the adoption petitioner's sexual orientation could have an impact on the child's best interests was consistent with existing law, close quote.
So basically, of course, you have the support of the Judicial Council and the individual judges who...
Not the Judicial Council, of the Illinois Courts Commission.
Illinois Courts Commission, I'm sorry.
Right.
I don't understand all this, these legal aspects of things, but I'm sure this is a... Anyway, of course, you have their support, and you have the support, certainly, of one of the people there who must have felt very, very strongly in your favor to write an independent opinion. Is that
right?
Sort of unusual situation?
Well, that's not really unusual. And what actually happened was we filed, we meaning myself and my attorney that I retained to represent me in this matter, we filed a motion to dismiss the complaints that was initially denied, and this one, it was denied with just a summary order, not giving any reasons, it just said it was denied. And this one Justice Robert Chapman, this one commissioner, who was an Illinois appellate court justice, he wrote his own opinion. At that time, it was a dissenting opinion, and he said he thought it should be dismissed, and he wrote a 6-page opinion explaining why. And he wrote that... he addressed every one of the rulings that they were objecting to, and as I said, the complaint was based entirely on disagreements with rulings where they said, I made this ruling and I did it because I was biased. And he went through each one of those rulings and pointed out the law and pointed out that I was legally correct with regard to each one of those rulings. and he found that I'm going to get his quote here. He found that the allegations did not, quote, amount to any trace of misconduct, close quote. And he is an Illinois appellate court judge. He's now retired, but he had been a judge on the Illinois appellate court for more than 20 years. And his opinion is very well written out. He gives great detail about the reasoning for his ruling.
Well, I think what's frightening to me, as you tell the story, is the fact that pressure groups can get judges or intimidate many good judges simply to not to do what they should do and not to uphold the law because, of course, they don't want to get people angry with them. They don't want to have to go through what you've gone through. And so it's easier sometimes simply to look the other way, simply to compromise the law and to say, well, it maybe really doesn't matter anyway. But once we get judges to begin to do that, the very fabric of civilization and Western civilization as we know it begins to be eroded. Do you feel that that we are in real trouble as this sort of thing probably goes on not only in your area but across America? Would that be a fair thing to say or not?
Well, I can't speak for what's going on in every other place or, you know, what every other judge is doing or thinking, but I know what the pressure is, and I know it was very difficult for me to do what I did, and at the time I was entering these orders, I was fully aware that it would be a very unpopular thing, that people would be very angry, and that I would be submitted to much pressure.
But you didn't realize it was going to go this far, did you?
I didn't know what exactly people were going to do, and I definitely would never have imagined that people would be so obsessed with this and unable to accept judicial determination regarding it. One, that they got their petitions approved, their adoptions approved, that would normally end a matter, even though I thought they hadn't gone about it in the right way because they were approved with no evidence ever having been presented, and that's just not the right way for things to proceed. Their children's rights were not upheld, in my opinion. They had a right to a hearing, and they had a right to all the evidence presented on the issues, and then you can appeal if you don't like the ruling the trial judge makes. I would not be the one making any final determination. And then the appellate court, if there was evidence presented on both sides of the issue, the appellate court would then have evidence to review and make a determination, which then would be binding on all the other trial judges. But they would be making a ruling based on evidence on both sides of the issue. Here, it got to the appellate court, and the appellate court approved it, and they were able to get it approved because there was nobody on the other side. And as I said, it's very easy for things to go through, even though a court has the duty to consider everything in both sides and all issues not even raised. When it involves children, it's a difficult thing to do, and it often doesn't happen.
Well, I feel very strongly, I feel very badly that you're having to go through all of these problems, but I certainly want to tell you that I do admire your willingness to do what was right, because this is what we need, is more people who do what's right rather than what is expedient, and I suspect that most of the judges there are men, aren't they?
No, we have a large percentage of women.
Yeah, really?
I don't know exactly what the percentage is. There are more men than women, but it's there's still a good percentage of women now on our court.
All right, fine. Well, of course, your courts are probably much more progressive than they are here, at least in our area where we are. So anyway, of course, we've only got a few minutes more. What sort of message would you like to leave to our listeners there, especially those that live in and around the Chicago area?
Well, I think the important thing is for people, there's a number of important points I think that my story kind of demonstrates. One thing is it definitely demonstrates the importance of voting. And November 2nd is coming up. There's many things on the ballot, and everyone's ballot across the country. It's very important to vote. Number two is, I believe, it's very important to have an elected judiciary. There's different systems in place in different states, and in Illinois there's a movement afoot by many groups to try to change the elective system to an appointment system where committees are formed to appoint judges, but I think my case just very clearly shows the danger with that, because when you have committees like that, they can't have much power over the judges. You have to please them in order to be selected to be on the bench, and then in order to stay on the bench, you need to stay popular with these commissions. And they have power to coerce judges to rule in certain ways, even the ways that they like, even if it's not in accord with what the law is. And by having an elected judiciary, that is a safeguard for the people to, for the judiciary to be independent and for the people to elect people, and not have people be judges just because they're popular with some certain group that happens to have the power to appoint. And another point, important thing is for people to realize the importance of educating, trying to educate themselves as much as possible about candidates for office, and also to be conscious of the importance of exercising discernment to regarding what they read and hear. Because what you see and what you read and hear is not always necessarily the truth. And you have to sort of read between the lines and develop your discernment. And then another point is, I think this case shows the difficulty that judges are faced when encountering their responsibility to fulfill the best interests of children. And I think that needs to be kept in mind with regard to our legislatures when they enact laws. The more specific those laws are, and the less discretion it gives to the judiciary, the more likely the intent of the legislature is going to be enforced.
Well, our ladies and gentlemen, our guest this evening has been Judge Susan McDunn, and you can go to her website at www.judgesusanmcdunn, and let me suggest that you do that, judgesusanmcdunn.com. Go there, get the information. I get the information out this weekend. The elections are coming up next week. We need a judge there who's willing to take a stand for what she believes in. We need more judges like you. The best of luck to you, and I'll be very interested in knowing how the election comes out. But you stand for what you believe in, no matter what happens.
Okay, thank you very much. I appreciate your support.
Good night, and God bless you.
Good night.
Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and of course this is a time when I need to remind all of our listeners here in the Monterey Bay area that we're having, and this will be the last time you'll hear this, we're having just a week from tomorrow, that's November the 6th, an all-day seminar at the Aptos Seascape Golf Course, and we're going to be bringing in some great guests, as Joe Schimmel is going to be there. And he's the fellow who did the videos. They sold their souls for rock and roll. And this is really not as much about rock and roll as about the spiritual battle that's going on and how it impacts on every aspect of our lives. And, of course, how that spiritual battle is changing the world in which we live in. And the world we live in today is not the world that I grew up in. The America I live in today is not the America I lived in 60 years ago. So, again, it's going to be at the Aptos Seascape Golf Course a week from tomorrow. We're going to have, of course, Michael Shaw will be there talking about sustainable development, which is a grand blueprint for the transformation of society, or, as Al Gore would talk about it, the wretching transformation of society. And believe me, there's going to be a lot of wrenching if they get their way. And then, of course, Bill Sardi is always one of our favorite guests. We'll be there talking about medical issues. And you really need to listen to Bill. You need to get his wisdom because he does a tremendous amount of reading. And he's right on the danger of so many vaccinations. Really, as I've told many times, I had the opportunity to talk to Ken Alibak, who's number two in man in the Soviet the biological warfare unit. And he told me he had taken 50 different vaccinations. He's allergic to just about everything. And as he said, you get all these vaccinations, you become so allergic, it eventually will kill you. Too many vaccinations will kill you. And yet, what are we doing? Why, we're working on 100 new vaccines for our children. I wonder why we're doing that. Well, let me just simply point out that it's going to be a great program. I'm going to give a talk. In fact, I'm working on it right now. I think it'll be a talk that you'll never forget. So if you'd like to come, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927, and we're going to have lunch. We have to know how many people are going to be there. And if you'd like to come, why, give us a call. And, of course, we have to get the reservations in this weekend. 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. The meeting will start. I would get there about 8:15 in the morning or earlier. The doors will open at 8 o'clock. And, of course, the meeting will start sharp at 8:45. And we'll just go all the way through to 5 o'clock, although there will be time for lunch. But it looks like a pretty good menu, even if I do say so. 1-800-544-8927. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and hearing Judge McDunn talk, wife reminds me, we do carry a book by Phyllis Lafley called The Supremacist, going into what the Supreme Court is doing to undermine and destroy our Constitution. Ben Bekdakian's book, I think, is important. It's called The New Media Monopoly, and, of course, it deals with the fact that there are five mega corporations that control the media in America and determine what the American people read, hear, see, and believe. So the book is The New Media Monopoly. Ben Bekdakian is the former dean of the School of Journalism in Berkeley. He has been studying this since 1983. At that time, there were 50 major corporations that dominated the media in America. Today, there were five. And that's how freedom is lost, when a few people, of course, control the power of the press and use it to push their political agenda. So those two books, I think, are very important. Of course, my book, The Brotherhood of Darkness, if you have not read it, you should. Or get the Brotherhood of Darkness book, the video and the audio tape, the so-called Brotherhood of Darkness special. And then, of course, we need to remind you that the shortwave frequencies are going to be changing as of Monday. Our afternoon program will be heard at 7.535. That's 3 to 5 on the West Coast and 6 to 8 on the East Coast. 7.535. But our evening program, the Angel One, will be at 7.535, so you can listen all day on that. But you may not get as good coverage as you will on other frequency, because Angel Two, the first hour of our evening program, will be at 5.835. That's 5.835. The second hour will be at 5.970. And this has to do with the change of frequencies during the winter months. And, of course, that gives you better coverage. And then they change back in the summer months. So the frequencies that we're going to will be that in that place until March the 26th. And then we will change back again. And, of course, as it always is, they wait until just the last minute to tell you what's going on. And I apologize. It's almost as if, it's almost as if somebody doesn't want our listeners to know how to find us. We hope, however, that if you ever have difficulty getting our shortwave, you call our 800 number, 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. Or you go to our website at radioliberty.com. That's radioliberty.com, www.radioliberty.com. And, of course, you can listen to us on the Internet there 5 hours a day, either directly or on the Radio Liberty Network or on the GCN Live Network or on the American News Net, AmericanNewsNet.com network, or the Republican Broadcasting Network, RBNLive.com, or on Soundwave2000.com. We're on the Internet on all of those various Internet sites, and so we hope that you'll be listening there on the Internet. And, of course, pull down the newsletters that we have and study those newsletters. Begin to understand, really, what's going on behind the scenes. And, of course, all of those newsletters are carefully documented, and they'll give you tremendous understanding of what's going on. And then, of course, we hope that you'll look at the various items we carry. We carry 3 or 4 items, and those items help us to stay on the air. We hope you'll tell others about our radio programs, about our Internet programs, about certainly our shortwave programs, or if you're in an area where you can hear this this program, and of course this program is being heard on six or eight stations across America tonight. Why tell others in your area to listen to our programs? Because we're going to tell you what's really going on. We're going to give you the news that Rush Limbaugh and Bill O'Reilly and Dan Rather and Tom Brokaw are paid so much not to tell the American people. And that is the truth about the spiritual battle behind everything going on today. I ask you to pray for America, to pray for revival, but please remember to pray for my ministry, Radio Liberty. Until Monday, this is Dr. Stan saying goodnight, and may the Lord be with you.